fill her up.
You're listening to the Gas Digital Network.
And now, Tim Dillon is going to hell.
Today, from sunny Los Angeles, we have a nice episode about human trafficking. We have Nick Bryant. Nick is the foremost expert on sex trafficking in America, specifically as it relates to the political class and political blackmail. He wrote a book called The Franklin Scandal, which details an interstate pedophile network that was operating out of Omaha, Nebraska in the 80s and 90s, peddling children to wealthy and powerful people in Washington, D.C. That book is a 7-year investigation into that particular topic. It has never before seen grand jury documents in it, and Nick has countless interviews with both victims and witnesses. It is an insanely disturbing book, and he paints a very troubling picture about what goes on. Nick Bryant also is the journalist that leaked Jeffrey Epstein's black book to Gawker, and he put it online. And that black book, of course, filled with very wealthy and powerful people. Last week, we did an episode about Jeffrey Epstein. We talked about why the plea deal he got was so insane and the links that people in the government were willing to go to cover up what was going on with Epstein's sex ring that he was running with a friend of his, Ghislaine Maxwell, a British socialite. Why this is such a great episode is we bring in Nick Bryant, who, again, is very careful and cautious. He's not somebody that makes claims that he can't back up, and he always talks about the things that he's done an extensive amount of research into. And we talk about the entire Epstein affair, what he thinks it is, who he thinks is behind it, why it's happening. Is he hopeful for the future? We get into all of that. We also touch briefly on some of the things in the Franklin scandal that have helped shape his opinion about these types of events. So Nick's a very interesting guy. He's walked down a lot of dark alleys, looked into a lot of dark subject matter, and he's working on a book right now about intelligence and blackmail in the historic context. It's fascinating. Listen to it. The conversation runs about an hour. It'll probably send you in a rabbit hole Googling, but that's what happens. So enjoy it. So Jeffrey Epstein's black book was taken by his house manager, and then I think instead of turning it over to the FBI, he actually tried to sell it to somebody who was an undercover FBI agent. Am I correct on that?
Indeed. He did try to sell it to an undercover FBI agent.
Okay. How did you come in contact with it?
That black book was added as discovery to a lawsuit against Epstein. And I was able to get it that way.
Right. Now, for people that don't know, Epstein was running a sex ring out of his out of a private island, Little St. James, which was located, I think, was it the British Virgin Islands, I believe?
The Virgin Islands, yes.
Yeah, so he had the Virgin Islands, and Jeffrey Epstein was a billionaire. He had homes in Manhattan. He had a 50,000-square-foot townhouse in Manhattan. At one time, it was Manhattan's largest private residence. He had a home in Palm Beach as well. And he also had this private island. And
he had a castle in New Mexico, too.
Wow. So he had a castle in New Mexico. And Epstein had made a lot of his fortune, because I pulled up some background on Epstein here. And they said, you know, he grew up middle class in Brooklyn. His father worked for the city's parks department. He went to great schools. He went to Brooklyn's Lafayette High School. And then he got a job teaching physics and math at Dalton, which is one of the most elite private schools in Manhattan. And then he began tutoring the son of a Bear Stearns chairman, Ace Greenberg, and was friendly with the daughter of Greenberg. So then he worked at Bear Stearns. And then under both Ace Greenberg and James Cain, and this is out of a Vanity Fair article, he did well enough to become a limited partner at Bear Stearns, and which is like a rung beneath what a full partner would be. And then he departed in 1981 because he wanted to run his own business, and that's where the Vanity Fair article says the details recede into shadow. So a few of the handful of current friends who have known him since the 1980s recall that he used to tell him he was a bounty hunter, recovering lost or stolen money for the government of very rich people. He had a license to carry a firearm. And then he started his own business, J. Epstein & Co. When you looked into him, in terms of just being, he was a financier, and you know, his mentor was
Les Wexner.
Yeah, Les Wexner, who had started, I believe, like Bath and Body Works and
Victoria's Secret.
Right, Victoria's Secret. So he started managing Wexler's money, and Wexler was worth, I believe, $3 or $4 billion when Epstein started working with him. And so when you look back at Epstein's past, did anything jump out at you as, you know, especially shady, or was this just kind of the story of a guy climbing the social ladder in Manhattan?
He did come from a blue-collar family in Brooklyn.
Right.
And so it wasn't easy for him to climb the social ladder that he climbed to make it to the apogee of society. I think there's some kind of pathological symbiosis between Jeffrey Epstein and Les Wexner. I think the majority of Epstein's money probably comes via Les Wexner.
Right. And Wexner, again, for people that don't know, is somebody who was the head of Victoria's Secret, Express, the clothing store, Bath and Body Works. He had a $3 billion empire. And Wexner saw in Jeffrey, this is out of Vanity Fair, the type of person who had the potential to realize his dreams. So he liked Jeffrey Epstein for whatever reason.
I think Vanity Fair didn't really understand that relationship. I think that there's something highly pathological about that relationship between Les Wexner and Jeffrey Epstein.
Right. Now, so illustrate what you think that might be.
I want to be very careful about, because what I've heard about that relationship is innuendo. So I want to be very cautious about naming exactly what I believe is involved in that relationship, but I just want to stick with highly pathological.
Okay.
And given what Jeffrey Epstein is into, it shouldn't be a big jump for your audience.
No, I imagine. Here's a few other things that I want to ask you about, too. So Jeffrey Epstein, and if anybody wants any background on this, our last episode details everything he was guilty of, but you basically had 80 girls, all, you know, the majority of them underage, or a lot of them underage, all corroborating each other's stories that Epstein or his friend Ghislaine Maxwell, who's a British socialite, had recruited them into a sex ring, who had brought them to Epstein's Island, and they performed sex acts on wealthy and powerful people. And then Jeffrey Epstein got a sweetheart deal from Jim Acosta, who's now the Secretary of Labor. And we detail all that in the previous episode. So if you need any background, you can check that one out. But Ghislaine Maxwell, Epstein's best friend, her father, Robert Maxwell, is widely believed, and by people like Seymour Hersh, very credible people, to have been an Israeli intelligence asset, as well as a media mogul. Robert Maxwell was a media mogul. He owned a lot of papers, the Mira and things like that. But in addition to that, there's a lot of intrigue about his life, and I don't know how closely you've looked into him, but it's curious to me that you have Epstein, who is a financier, running a sex ring with the daughter of a potential intelligence asset. Is that significant to you in any way?
Yes. With Maxwell, as I said earlier, Jeffrey Epstein came from a blue-collar family. It was Maxwell's connections that allowed him to ascend to Mount Olympus. I mean, he had the money, but he didn't have the social connections. And Maxwell's social connections enabled him to, as I said before, ascend to Mount Olympus.
Right. And when we talk about sexual blackmail, which is a lot of work that you have done on that particular topic. And just to bring people up to speed, a lot of these operations, not only the Franklin scandal where you had a townhouse in a very ritzy area of Washington, D.C. called Colorama, where they would have these orgies where you'd have very powerful and wealthy people having sex with underage kids that were brought in. Those houses were outfitted with surveillance equipment, cameras to I believe, capture people in compromising positions. Is it your belief that Epstein's Island was a similar situation where it was not only, you know, this pleasure island where you had people going and participating in these sex parties, but it was also some type of blackmail operation?
I do believe that. And I think the evidence shows that Epstein knew that he was going to be raided by the Palm Beach Police Department. So he had a lot of time to get rid of his blackmail accoutrements. But the Palm Beach Police Department still found hidden cameras in his home. So his home did have hidden cameras. And the way that Epstein has operated, I would be very surprised if he isn't blackmailing people. But the thing about Epstein is, and the thing about the Franklin scandal is, it's very difficult for someone to blackmail powerful people. It's just, I mean, powerful people have access to their own thugs and mercenaries and whatever. And I think that someone in Jeffrey Epstein's position has to have someone behind him, has to have an organization behind him to ensure that he's going to be able to blackmail these people.
Correct. So that's a great point, because it takes me into another area of questioning. So you have somebody like Jeffrey Epstein who's able to, by the way, I mean, he was trying to, I don't know if he had done it successfully or if he had tried to do it, but he was trying to basically traffic, I mean, girls as young as 13 in from other countries, okay? At that point—
Actually, there's a case of him buying girls in Eastern Europe.
Okay, so but who would he be buying them from?
It's hard to say. In that type of milieu, there are traffickers that, and I found that out to be the case in the Franklin scandal. There are kids that are for sale in the United States of America. So Americans have this delusion that they're like, people, the kids trafficked in America aren't American children, but 70% of the children trafficked to 80% of the children trafficked in America are American children. And there's also a lot of incidents where pedophiles buy American kids. So this is happening all over. It's just not happening in America. It's just not happening in Eastern Europe. Wherever there's a demand, there's a supply.
Right. And where would you estimate a lot of these, and this is, you know, this is everything about the story is tragic, but one of the things that I find especially tragic about this is, where do they really get these kids from? Are they, you know, from reading your book and from a lot of the work that you've done, are they from broken homes? Are they from orphanages? Are they from, you know, they're not high up on the socioeconomic ladder, these kids. They're kind of kids that disappear relatively easily. Is that your understanding?
Yes. Orphanages are a great source for kids, but then there's all kinds of kids that just fall through the cracks. I mean, they're from dysfunctional families and they fall through the cracks. And as soon as they fall through the cracks, predators are there to ensnare them. But predators really know how to prey. So they will, there's a number of mechanisms by which they get children.
Right. Now, so you have Epstein and Maxwell. Another thing that I wanted to, the actual Black Book itself, which has certain names in it that are circled. So the Black Book, again, Epstein's a billionaire. He lives in New York City. Everybody's in that book, Black Book. You know, everybody's had dinner at his house. You know, he's got this 50,000 square foot townhouse. He's probably throwing a lot of parties. It's not uncommon that he is, you know, he's a well-known, well-connected figure. But there were certain people in that Black Book who had their names circled, and there were some you know, there was some writing in that black book as well. Did any of that suggest to you that those people were of any specific importance? Now, the guy, the house manager, ended up dying of an illness later, so he'd never really discussed the black book. But in your looking at it and trying to did that black book suggest to you that there were nuggets of information that were kind of buried in it as well?
Actually, the house manager, when he sold that black book to the FBI, the undercover FBI agent, the FBI said that the people that were circled were material witnesses. And you can decipher that any way you want. But a number of the names that are circled, according to the house manager, were involved in Epstein's pedophilic enterprise.
Okay. There was somebody, this is very interesting. There was a man named Dana Giacchetto. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but next to Courtney Love's name in the black book, they had all these arrows to this guy named Dana Giacchetto, who was this Hollywood money manager. He was a financial advisor to the stars, and actually he, you know, it was a Ponzi scheme and like everything else, you know. I think he died of a drug overdose, but he was actually, interestingly enough, one of the original investors in something called the Digital Entertainment Network. The Digital Entertainment Network was the company at the heart of the Bryan Singer lawsuits, where, you know, Bryan Singer and other investors were accused of molesting underage boys. So you have this guy who is, you know, connected to Epstein, connected to everybody in Hollywood. You know, how much of this, Nick, do you think is related? You have people that have these predilections, people that have these appetites and have lots of money out there. How much of this stuff is connected, and how much of it do you think is just people kind of running their own independent operations? You know, have you looked much into, you know, a lot of the abuse of underage men and women in Hollywood?
I've looked at it, but I haven't studied it like I've studied other types of abuse. But yes, there is that nexus with Bryan Singer and Epstein's black book. And it's like drug addicts know where to find each other, and they know where to score. I mean, pedophiles are the same way. They know how to find each other, and they know how to score. I mean, it's a very similar thing. And as I said before, wherever there's a demand, there's going to be a supply.
I've asked you this before, I think. Why are there so many wealthy and powerful people that seem to be into this? Is it your belief that pedophilia is a sexuality like any type of sexuality that you're either it's innate or it's something that develops over time when you become sexually aware? Or are you some type of belief that these people are on the spectrum of sociopath to a degree? And, you know, I've heard some theories that, like, they're bored, they've done everything else, everything's available to them, so they're like, why not this? What is your belief? You've looked at this issue as closely as anyone.
All the above, Tim. The thing about it is, pedophiles come from all social strata, so it's just not rich guys.
Right.
You know, molesting children. I mean, they come from all social strata. According to, I think, a study that was published about 3 or 4 years ago, 17% of women are molested by their family. So when you get into like teachers and priests and coaches, I mean, that number starts to rise. And the average person that enters the sex industry enters it at the age of 13. So with that type of situation, you've got these kids that are just floating around, and they're lapped up. And some of them are lapped up by people living in trailer parks, and some of them are lapped up by people living in mansions. I think what we have seen, we saw this with Epstein, and we also saw it with the Franklin scandal, is that people living in mansions don't have to pay a price for molesting children.
Right.
Now, they molest, they're molesting children with impunity.
Now, why would you say that is? Is it simply because they are wealthy and that the criminal justice system has a different set of rules for wealthy people? Or because of blackmail and because of other elements, are they, is there like some level of what I would call mutually assured destruction here? Where,
yes.
Okay, so explain that.
Well, it's, if you're molesting kids with someone, I mean, it's like the mafia's omerta, the vow of silence. I mean, who's going to break that vow? I talked to a blackmail photographer, and I asked him about it. And he said, he made this analogy. He said, it's, you're on a yacht, and it's a sunny day. It's a beautiful day, and you're on this beautiful yacht, and you can have anything that you want. But if you decide to get off the yacht, the people on the yacht are going to make sure that you drown. So that is the mutually assured destruction that you're talking about.
How do we, how does it come to be that you have somebody like Epstein blackmailing people? Do you think that he was approached by, I mean, do you speculate that this was an operation that was, you know, a Mossad operation? Do you think it's CIA? Do you think it's, I mean, if you had to guess or you had to speculate on who the group is that is behind Epstein's operation from your research, what would you say?
Well, both the Mossad and CIA are known for blackmail, but I find it difficult to believe that the CIA would allow the Mossad to blackmail power brokers, especially the type of power brokers that are in Epstein's black book, by themselves. I mean, it might have been the Mossad, but the CIA was there.
Right. So if it's the Mossad, the CIA is involved. It's a group effort.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right. And that makes sense. And essentially, when they have these photos or they have these videos of people, do you know where these things are kept and who? Because, again, this is the third rail. It could ruin careers, ruin lives. Who is in charge of keeping this information?
That's kind of an interesting question. J. Edgar Hoover was quite the blackmail artist. And then he was kind of a malignant dwarf that was a blackmail artist. And I think after, and he had a lot of people blackmailed, a lot of people in politics. And I think after he died, the political blackmail moved primarily over to the CIA. This is what I believe. I don't have definitive proof on it, but this is what I believe. And I think that the CIA definitely has files on a lot of people. And
when you talk about the CIA, do you mean the actual, you know, Langley, Virginia CIA, or are you talking about like a small underground, you know, sect of the CIA?
Yes, I'm talking about like wayward intelligence people.
Okay, now explain that, wayward intelligence people. I love that term. Explain that.
They are people that are involved in black ops that are generally off the books. And we've seen the CIA has been able to cover up a lot of stuff with the mind control experimentation that they did. I mean, they really destroyed a lot of people in trying to find, in trying to create a Manchurian candidate. So, and no one, you know, I've talked to someone who is very high ranking in the CIA when the CIA was conducting those mind control experiments, and he didn't have a clue about it. And he was very high ranking, and I believe him. So I think that there's this dark little pocket of intelligence people, but it's just not intelligence people. It's kind of a nexus of intelligence people, Justice Department, and also FBI and other domestic law enforcement that are involved together. And then when you see, like with the Franklin scandal and also with Epstein, when you see these guys that have molested God knows how many children just walking, I mean, you're going to need the Justice Department to acquiesce, and you're going to also need the FBI to acquiesce. Now, from what I understood about the Epstein case, and this is kind of heartening given how ugly and dark this subject is, I was told that the Justice Department was gung-ho on covering up Epstein, but the FBI balked. The FBI in Miami did not want to cover this up. So they let the Justice Department do it exclusively. I mean, and the Justice Department had the power to do that. I mean, of course they do. But that was kind of heartening for me. If that is in fact the case, that the FBI in Miami just said, we're not going to get involved in this, it's just too malignant. That's kind of heartening
and
for me.
Right. Now that the case was covered up, now there is a new push to reopen the case, but reexamine the Justice Department's handling of the case. And there's going to be, I think a judge just ruled that they're going to release certain files pertaining to the investigation. Do you hope that this is going to shed more light on whatever took place? Or do you think, much like the Kennedy assassination, where they release files all the time, you know, a lot of the people that have done the truly horrible things are going to be insulated from consequences, as they often seem to be?
I've been following the court trials of Epstein as they've wended over the years. And Judge Mara, the judge overseeing that case, seems to be a reasonable guy. I mean, seems to be. And a number of attorneys have really pushed very hard for this. And ultimately what happened with this, with the Epstein situation, was really egregious, because victims of abuse have to be notified when their abuser is getting sentenced. And none of the victims of Epstein were notified. And the feds had about a list of, at that point, 35 kids that had been molested by Epstein, and none of them were notified. So that's more malfeasance by the Department of Justice. And that is the loophole of why we're trying to open up those documents, is because the victims of Epstein weren't notified.
What do you think would be, if you had to take a guess, what's in these documents? Are you going to see things like Bill Clinton, who was on his plane 27 times? Are you going to see anything about Prince Andrew, who was a close friend and confidant? Are you going to see anything about Kevin Spacey, who was on that plane? Are you going to see anything about other powerful people? In your estimation, what do you think is in those documents? How damning are they?
Those documents could be very damning, but I'm cautiously optimistic. The FBI did not engage in the kind of investigation that it should have. I think it more or less stepped away from the investigation. The Palm Beach Police Department was really, really valiant in going after Jeffrey Epstein. The chief, Ritter, was just hammered by a number of people for his persistence, and he was followed, and there were a lot of thuggish tactics that were used against him, and he really, really was quite valiant. And in these situations, you see people really standing up to the machine, and they're heroic. Like, the police chief Ritter was very, very heroic in what he did.
Right. Now, do you think, you know, people talk about, there's a lot of conspiracy theories that involve Bill and Hillary Clinton. I know that you've taken a look at a lot of political figures and how sexual blackmail is used against them. How much do Bill and Hillary Clinton come up in the things that you've looked at? And do you think that when they are talked about, is it more conspiracy-minded people that are just trying to insert the Clintons into things? Or do you think from, you know, what you've researched or what you've come to believe, that they are, you know, people like Bill Clinton, who again was on Epstein's plane repeatedly, are, you know, either serial abusers of, I mean, where do you come down on that?
Well, I think Bill Clinton has shown that he's a serial abuser. I don't think there's any doubts about that. Anybody that's taken a hard look at Bill Clinton in this area knows that he's a serial abuser. And Jeffrey Epstein had like 22 contact numbers
right
for Bill Clinton. So obviously, given Bill Clinton's history and Jeffrey Epstein having 22 contact numbers for him, and also Bill Clinton being on those planes, because when I published the Black Book on Gawker, I also threw in a bunch of flight receipts too, which showed Bill Clinton and Alan Dershowitz and Kevin Spacey et al. On those planes.
Where do those flight receipts go? Are any of them landing on the island?
The ones that I managed to acquire, no.
But you probably can't land a big jet on that island, right? I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, you probably couldn't. And, but it's kind of interesting. Alan Dershowitz was on a number of those flights. And if you look at the article I wrote for Gawker, it's pretty obvious that he's not telling the truth.
Right. So, I mean, he's somebody who said when the documents come out, he'll be exonerated. And other people have said if the documents come out, he'll be in more trouble. So it's hard to know.
Well, I would just tell your listeners to go to Nick Bryant and Gawker and look at the article that I wrote on Alan Dershowitz, and they can decide whether or not they think he's telling the truth.
Now, this nexus of intelligence people and Justice Department people that you called wayward, which I like. What unites them? I mean, clearly they're not all pedophiles. So what unites this particular group of people that's involved in some very nefarious activities? What would you think it would be? I mean, is it just a group of people where they have a financial interest in doing the types of activities they do? Me and you have had discussions about this. You know, everyone talks about these fraternities, these, you know, secret groups, whether it's, you know, the Skull and Bones or people going and meeting at the Bohemian Grove. And, you know, I had believed for a long time that they were essentially, you know, I don't want to say harmless, but somewhat, you know, that they were fraternal organizations where people were just kind of looking to make connections with the right people. But knowing what you do about some of these very powerful people, are there feeder organizations into this dark nexus where, like, you know, if you're in the right group, you're in the right fraternity, the right school, the right, and you're into this stuff, is there an occult element in any of these things? I mean, what do you come down on in terms of like what unites these people, if anything?
Well, I think when you get into the government side of it, it's about power. It's simply about power. And if they're not pedophiles, I'm sure that they've got dirt on one another. I mean, that's what I think. If you want to look at – now, this is kind of interesting because when you start talking about secret societies and this type of stuff, you know, it gets kind of out there and people like to go conspiracy theory. But ABC News did a few interesting pieces some years ago on a group of Masons called the Gestures, and they would take – trips down the Amazon River, and at every port that they would stop at, they'd be supplied with underage girls. So in that instance, you had definitely people that were Masons or in fairly high up to be a gesture, molesting kids. And actually there was a governor too that was involved in that. So, and the occult shows up here and there too with this type of thing. I think that that the occult plays a role, but it's overall a minor role. And if you look at the amount of child abuse that's going on, I think the occult plays a relatively small role in the totality of the abuse.
Right. Now, what would you say that role would be? Is it just simply that people that are involved in certain sects of certain religions or belief systems are willing to do things that other people aren't, so that there's just some natural alliance between maybe, you know, people in the intelligence community that need people that are willing to do things, or need, you know, people that traffic in children, or, you know, because I know you had written an article on the Finders, which were a cult that were caught with children, and you had written that there's a, you know, in the Franklin scandal, there is people that have reported that they were victims of ritual abuse. And me and you had had prior conversations that ritual abuse in many cases was trying to torture children so that they would disassociate themselves, and they would split up into multiple personalities so that those personalities could be programmed to be maybe assassins, maybe sex slaves, maybe things like that. So is that why? Because, and we know this, you know, that we know that MK Ultra took place. We know that it happened. We know that the CIA was involved in drugging children, experimenting on children. And then those two words that you always talk about where you say, quote unquote, psychological tricks, that the CIA played psychological tricks on children. Is that where you think this occult minor role comes in, that those psychological tricks were actually being performed by cults? Or, yeah.
I would not venture to guess on that, but as there are occult entities that their highest sacrament is the defilement of innocence. And that's what they're into. They derive, reportedly, they derive some type of power from the defilement of innocence. That's their highest sacrament.
What type of you say that there's occult entities? Who would they be? What are we talking about?
We're talking about occult entities that are very, very dark, that definitely that worship on the dark side of humanity. And when you get into dissociation, yes, those people dissociate, or the victims of those occult entities dissociate. Now, there was a really great study done. It's called the Extreme Abuse Survey, and I would suggest that your listeners look it up on the internet. I've talked to it was conducted by four people. It was a two were American and two were German, and the research is pretty good. And it gets into extreme abuse, and there is a nexus between the occult and also government mind control. Right. That the Extreme Abuse Survey definitely shows that.
Right. Are you, you know, when you went to go research the Franklin scandal, you were threatened. I believe somebody, you were staying at a friend's house, and then a woman showed up and knocked on the door. I mean,
yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? I mean, that was a real, I mean, the fact that you kept going on with this research is really impressive. What happened with that? And this was like a few days after you had started, right?
Well, it was my first trip to Nebraska looking into the Franklin scandal. And I was sitting on my friend's couch watching television, and a woman came to the door. He lived in an apartment, and a relatively large apartment building. And a woman came to the door and said that she wanted to give me a book. And at this point, I mean, I'd been followed, and there'd been some other stuff that had gone down that made me very leery. And I did not want to open that door, primarily because I didn't want my fingerprints to be on that book. And I didn't want her fingerprints to be in my friend's apartment. I mean, that was the bottom line. I was worried that I might get set up. And then she, you know, I told her to leave, and she eventually left. And then my friend came home, and then she returned. And I told my friend, you know, I said, I'm really reluctant to be tied to her with fingerprints or have her fingerprints in your house. I think it, you know, this could be a setup. So we opted not to let her into the house, but she did say that I was going to get killed or something to that effect.
Right. Nice. Sweet, sweet woman.
Yeah.
And you still went, do you ever, you know, you've published a book on these people. You leaked Epstein's black book. Are you ever worried about your own personal safety?
Not at this point. I have a lot of stuff that's floating around.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, I put all my interviews on CDs.
Right.
And I gave them out. Now, there's a lot of people that come up, some very powerful people that come up on my interviews that I couldn't name in the Franklin scandal because I didn't have the corroboration.
Right. I remember when we turned the mics off in the studio and we had that talk off mic, it was harrowing.
So if something should happen to me, I mean, I'm safer now that that stuff is, that the Franklin scandal is out there. And I think my opponents underestimated me. They thought that I was probably just another spineless journalist from New York. And once they put a little heat on me, that would be the end of my sojourns to Omaha, Nebraska, and to Washington, D.C., too. But I was pretty committed. Once I realized that it was a reality, I didn't go there knowing that it was a reality. But once I realized that it was reality, and I did talk to some of the victims and other people that had been involved, I just decided, you know, I've got to do this. I've got to go for it. I mean, I can't let anyone stop me from doing this.
So in a way, for your own insurance, you put some of the interviews and some of the things that you couldn't disclose in the book, you have them out there in case,
yes.
In case anything happens to you, they'll find their way somewhere.
Yes, they're floating around and they will hit the internet.
Do you think something like Pizzagate, which is largely, you know, probably a creation of these, you know, these message boards like 4chan and Reddit. Do you think, you know, from what you've looked into, and you're the guy, and I remember calling you when this was all happening because you're the guy that knows more than anyone else does about this. Was there any validity or any grain of truth to that? Or did you think that was, you know, completely something that was, you know, invented, you know, this idea that that pizzeria or the owners of that pizzeria were involved in any activities like the ones that you had previously looked at?
I'm kind of agnostic about Pizzagate. I will say that there's a lot of smoke there. So
right.
I will say that. But I...
Shout out to A-Chan.
There was one lead I had on that could have probably helped me discern whether or not it was true and also its scope, but I followed up on the lead, but I just couldn't reel it in. So, yes, at this point, I'm kind of agnostic about it.
What do you think the future is that these groups will continue operating with impunity forever? Is, you know, it's been going on for millennia, you know, is the system at this point really too big, too corrupt to ever truly get the type of justice that people would want?
Well, the thing is, when you've got a disease, and this is definitely a disease in our society, you need awareness of the disease before you can take action. And unfortunately, a lot of Americans are like ostriches. They've just got their head in the sand. They do not want to look at things like the Franklin scandal or Epstein. I'm really proud of what the Miami Herald has done.
Yeah.
Because I tried to sell the Epstein story to every single magazine in New York, and I could not find a buyer. So I'm glad that they stepped up to the plate. And Americans just have to be, I really do believe that if Americans had the correct information, they would do the correct thing. And I think that, like, the Miami Herald articles and the Franklin scandal, although it's been a battle with the Franklin scandal, But I think more and more people are beginning to understand that this is probably a reality in their political structure.
How high up would you imagine this goes? Without naming names, how high up? Because a lot of people, the Franklin scandal, were talking about the White House. You know, so would you be comfortably saying that, you know, this reaches so high up that this could destroy an entire, you know, political organization, whether it's a political party or whether it's an administration? Like, at the height of the Franklin scandal's power, had it become known, what do you think would have happened?
Well, some people in Nebraska had to die, be murdered. So it would not become known. What I believe about that is more and more Americans will hopefully become aware of this, and ultimately it'll get out. But I think it goes very, very high. And just the fact, if you look at Epstein and you look at the power that was deployed to keep that under wraps. I mean, what Acosta, that deal that Acosta sanctioned was completely criminal. I mean, it was a non-prosecution agreement for everyone that was affiliated with Epstein, even perpetrators. I mean,
right.
It was mind-boggling. And then he gets, and then he becomes Secretary of Commerce. I mean, that's kind of mind-boggling too to me.
You also were a co-author on a book called Confessions of a DC Madam with, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this name right, Henry Vinson?
Yes, Vinson.
And what was that book about? Because I would love people to actually go and find that book too. You know, other than the Franklin scandal, which is a must, you should really buy that. What was it? Was that examining the political blackmail aspect more?
Yes, Henry ran a gay escort service. And a couple of CIA assets who were actually involved in the Franklin scandal would use his gay escorts to compromise people. And that's what that book is about, is his personal experience going into that dark world of sexual blackmail.
And didn't he also make some comment where, like, there were people that were reaching out to him who wanted, like, kids that could essentially disappear?
Yes, he was being pressured to provide them with kids, but he would not do that. He felt what goes on between consenting adults is completely cool. But
agreed,
he would not participate in providing anyone with children.
Right, because they said that we want kids, and on top of that, it was like kids that were going to disappear, you know?
Yes,
Is it your belief? Let me just throw this out there, because this is we're at the point in the thing. We got a few more questions left, and you know, we've done a lot of fact based stuff, which is great. When you hear these stories about these occult rituals where people are sacrificing children, and some of it is in John DeCamp's book, children are being cooked, and you know, there was that woman Kathy, I forget her name. But right after she had that little article where she described cults sacrificing children, she got killed in a head-on car crash. Is there validity to that stuff to you, where you go at these, you know, quote-unquote power meetings, which you wrote about in your book, where you have children being sacrificed? I mean, again, this is – I'm a stand-up comedian. This is something that I don't really – come in contact with. I mean, every day online, people talk about
it. I mean, most people don't come in contact with it.
What? So well, what would you say about that? Is that something that you feel is something that may, or is like, is that going on? Did it go on?
Well, the thing about it is, if you look at all the people that claim to be victims of that, and they basically tell the same kind of story, I would have to surmise that that is definitely a part of this. We're getting more into the occult thing, which I commented on. But yes, definitely, I would suggest that you look at the Extreme Abuse Survey, and
it's your belief as a journalist, as somebody who's looked into this, that it's very possible that people in high-ranking positions of power in this country have participated in, like, rituals where you have children not only being abused but potentially killed.
Yes. I mean, a lot of people that have claimed to be victims have talked about that. And there was three people in the Franklin scandal that talked about it. Three victims in the Franklin scandal that talked about it.
And why a lot of that seems to be happening in the heartland? And is there just some – what's going on in the heartland? Why is there so much occult activity in the middle of the country?
No, I think there's occult activity everywhere.
Okay.
But one has to be very cautious, too, because the woman that you talked about, Kathleen Sorensen, was in the head-on. I investigated that.
Uh-oh. And am I wrong?
I concluded that, yeah, and I talk about it in the Franklin scandal. I concluded that she was not – that was not a hit. She was not murdered. It was an accident. It was just a straight accident.
What about that older couple that was looking into the Child Protective Services from Georgia? Have you read about that?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. What about that?
You're talking about Diane Schaefer.
Yes, I am.
Yes, that is something that needs to be investigated.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, at least you give me that one. That one, because she was saying that Child Protective Services was essentially providing children to traffickers or whatever, and then her and her husband ended up being taken out.
Yeah, that obviously, I mean, it just shows you when someone like that is murdered and the authorities come up with some really incompetent answer, it shows you that that is a cover-up. I mean, that is definitely a cover-up.
Yeah. Before I let you go, what new – are you working on a new book? Are you working on new articles? What are you – are you gonna write about any lighter subject matters in the future?
You know, I'm writing my third book on intelligence blackmail, sexual blackmail right now.
All right, so you're staying close to home.
I mean, that seems to be my niche. I used to make a lot more money when I wrote about things that weren't so dark and esoteric. But
are all these intelligence agencies acting in their own interest, or do you think there's far more cooperation between them than we know? Like, for example, there was something called the Safari Club, where I think after the family jewels had come out and after the CIA was somewhat neutered, and when, you know, George H.W. Bush was then installed as the, you know, the head of the CIA.
The CIA director, yeah.
CIA director, right. They couldn't really get away with a lot of stuff they were doing anymore. So what they tried to do was build this network of foreign intelligence services that would be kind of directed by, you know, some of the wayward people in the U.S. intelligence community that couldn't get away with what they were doing officially or even unofficially. So what they were trying to do. So when you look at these different intelligence agencies and how they operate, do we just train criminals? Like, are we just training people to be incredibly deceptive and skillful, and then we just hope that they're not bad people? Because with CIA training, you could kind of go out in the world and do whatever you wanted.
Yes. I mean, when you get into that, between the church hearings, which outed the CIA on a number of illicit enterprises that it was involved in, and then Carter taking over, there was a lot of CIA people that were banished. But as soon as Reagan took over, they were quickly assimilated again. So, but I still could think, regardless, there is that dark pocket of intelligence people that, regardless of what administration is in effect, it still exists and it still operates and it still blackmails people and engages in various illicit activities. Yes.
Yeah. And that could include trafficking of drugs, trafficking of people, you know, political assassinations, blackmail, all of that stuff.
Yes. Yes, I do believe that.
And just a final question. Are you, you know, when it comes to Trump, and I know you don't follow horse race politics too much, we don't really do a ton of that on the show. What do you make of a character like Donald Trump? What is a guy like you? You're in a, you know, interesting position. You write about stuff that you really don't, you know, your stuff bleeds into the papers every now and then, but you're always writing and researching and doing great work. What does someone like Donald Trump, Is he somebody that terrifies the establishment? Do we buy that angle? Or is he really just kind of an establishment guy that conned a lot of people into thinking he wasn't? Does he split the difference? Where are you on him?
Well, I mean, Donald Trump, I believe, is severely compromised. If a porn star and a Playboy bunny can extort you, I mean, how difficult would it be for the CIA to blackmail you? I mean, it's and not only sexually, but also financially, too. There's a lot of malfeasance. So I do not believe, I mean, that Donald Trump is not, Donald Trump has to be compromised. I firmly believe that.
Right. Very interesting. And he hasn't done anything he said he was going to do. And everybody wonders why. And it's like, well, it's very possible that he can't do it because, you know, he's being handled, you know?
Well, if you look at, I mean, he's amped defense spending. Right. He's deregulated financing. And then he passed a tax bill, which will probably be a huge redistribution of wealth. So, I mean, he is doing exactly what the American oligarchs want their presidents to do.
Right. Absolutely.
Nick, I mean, there's a dog and pony show, but I think that's just what it is a dog and pony show.
Where can people find you? I'm sure that they're going to be curious about your work. Where can they get the book? Where can they maybe, do you have a website?
Yeah, you can, franklinscandal.com.
Right. Franklinscandal.com. It's a fun, we got the summer coming up. It's a great beach read.
Yeah.
I read it on the beach. I'm not the typical person, but I read it on the beach.
Read it on the beach. Some people might read it before they go to bed, but
right.
I would imagine that it probably wouldn't engender the best dreams.
When is the next book coming out about the intelligence blackmail? When can we look forward to that? Do you have an idea yet or not really?
I'm on the home stretch of it. So
is Trump included in that book?
No. This it's actually going to be a different kind of book than the other two, but I'm going to take more of a historical look at CIA sexual blackmail in this book, and then ultimately the sexual honey trap or the honey trap blackmail operation that I talk about in this book leads to something very seismic politically, and I will wait until the book is published to tell you.
Interesting. Okay. Well, they're all being controlled. Everybody's being blackmailed. The democracy is completely compromised. It's going to be a real fun next 50 years.
Well, if Americans can wake up to
Nick,
how
already not going to happen. I love your thoughts, but the if Americans can wake up, those five words, I mean. Have you met them? Have you gone out and met the Americans?
I meet Americans occasionally, and I still haven't lost faith.
Okay, well, good for you. So you're saying if they wake up, there's a chance that potentially we can, you know, there can be some positive changes made.
Well, the thing about it is, like with the Franklin scandal, I think those dominoes would have definitely fallen all the way to Washington, D.C., had people not been murdered. And ultimately, Americans would have seen that their political system is predicated on blackmail, and not only predicated on blackmail, but it'll even destroy children in its quest for blackmail. I think once Americans really understand that, and I think that they can, I think that people are getting more and more disillusioned. Unfortunately, there's this huge dialectic of divide and conquer, where you've got like Fox News and you've got MSNBC, and the liberals hate the conservatives and the conservatives hate the liberals. And unfortunately, we've fallen into that, and where we're so polarized that way. And I think that if Americans can realize that they're being played the way that they're being played, I think that they could possibly wake up.
Well, we hope so. Nick Bryan, thank you for coming on and talking to us about this. You're always welcome. We're huge fans of you. Go to the franklinscandal.com, order the book, read the book. When you have your next book and it comes out, please come back on and promote that book. We would love to see you. We really want to see you get the recognition you deserve because you do some amazing work, and we really appreciate you lending us your expertise.
Thanks, Tim.
All right. Thanks, buddy. Have a good night.
Yeah, you too.